from PowerlineBlog.com. This is Powerline with John Hinderacher, Scott Johnson, Paul Mieringoff, and Stephen Hayward.
Hi, everybody. It's Stephen Hayward sitting in solo for a Powerline podcast today. Because the election's over, that is, it's over for everyone not named Jill Stein or Hillary Clinton, and that means we can now finally get back to the important things, like the Beach Boys. Except that we can't. Just leave it to the New York Review of Books to take something cuddly and warm like the Beach Boys and turn it into yet another excuse for politically correct identity politics groveling. In the issue the New York Review of Books published right before the election, some loser of a writer had this to say, quote, "But time and social change have been rough on the Beach Boys. Their best-known hits, say California Girls, Help Me Rhonda, or I Get Around, are poems of unenlightened straight male privilege, white privilege, beach privilege. It is hard to imagine that they helped anyone towards self-determination or achieving their social rights," end quote. Oh, please, beach privilege? Probably the problem is too many beaches have white sand, I suppose. Although, come to think of it, this politically correct take on the Beach Boys is arguably an inverse indicator of what has happened to California, which is now a firmly entrenched center-left state. It accounts for the entire margin of Hillary Clinton's popular vote victory. Take away California's margin and Donald Trump wins the rest of the country handily. Take away California and New York and Trump wins the rest of the country by a landslide. Hey, maybe this California secession idea isn't so bad after all. But what happened to California? It was once the headquarters of Reagan country, the place that once built bombers and fighter planes and moon rockets, and now gives us boutique electric cars and Twitter. It was a place where you could once upon a time enjoy the Beach Boys without the overlay of obligatory white guilt. Well, as it happens, we caught up recently with the writer who has shed more light than anyone on what's happened to California, the long-term greatness of the Beach Boys, and a whole lot of other subjects, including even Machiavelli. And it's Michael Anton. Listen in. Michael Anton joins us now. Michael writes primarily for the City Journal of the Manhattan Institute and the Claremont Review of Books from our good friends at the Claremont Institute. But Michael, before we get into some specific questions about some of your great pieces, remind me and our listening audience, you've had a long career in government and the private sector, but in government for household names like, I think, Condoleezza Rice, Secretary of State, Powell, I think. Who else? Run down the list a little bit.
Not Powell. I started in politics as a speechwriter for Pete Wilson when he was the governor of California, right, the last non-Rhino Republican governor of California probably ever. although at the time, you know, the California Republican Party was quite roiled about Pete Wilson. When we still had a Republican Party, there were the conservatives and the moderates, and Wilson was the leader of the moderates and the bete noire of the conservatives. And I bet a lot of those conservatives, if they didn't live in other states now, they'd love to get Wilson back. But that's an argument for another day.
Oh, yeah. No, I remember busting his chops a lot, now thinking, boy, wouldn't we like him back in a heartbeat, right?
Wouldn't we like him back in a heartbeat? He wouldn't be electable now. And then for Rudy Giuliani when he was the mayor of New York, and for George W. Bush as president, Condoleezza Rice as national security advisor, and just a little bit. I didn't go with her to the State Department, but I did some things for her as she was confirmed and in her early months before she got the whole team together.
Right. And then from there you went on to the private sector and worked as a, what, communication specialist, writer, speechwriter for?
For Rupert Murdoch.
Right.
For about 3 years after I left the White House. And I kind of bounced around consulting and corporate stuff ever since.
Right, right. So the first topic I want to talk to you about is our native home state, both you and I from California, and have watched it transform dramatically in our lifetimes. And you wrote a long piece about San Francisco values, I think it was, in the Claremont Review.
Yeah.
And I'm fascinated with Silicon Valley, with the ethos of the place, which you'd think this entrepreneurial place would be more conservative or at least more skeptical of government, but it turns out to be quite liberal.
Yeah.
And this is a puzzle, I think.
I think there's a couple of ways that you can answer that or that maybe explain it. One is just that liberalism has become, you know, the old liberalism of wealth redistribution is just so passe now. It's just so very, very 1930s and, you know, proletariat struggles and stuff like that. And the left hasn't really been about that in 50 years. It's, beginning with the boomers in the 60s, it's when it started, when leftism became more about cultural status signifiers than about wealth redistribution and you know, equality of opportunity and equality of outcome. And that's just accelerated, and that is completely what defines liberalism in Silicon Valley today. Except for the one other factor, which is a lot of these guys are rent seekers that are living off government largesse, that are getting gigantic contracts and subsidies and stuff. And so it's really kind of hilarious that some of the big heroes of, you know, the, supposedly these Randian. All right. So, I mean, so the first reason is, you know, cultural status signifiers. And the, but the second is that they live off government largesse. And some of these guys who are really lionized as some sort of, you know, Randian new man type entrepreneurial heroes like Elon Musk. And I'm not taking anything away from Musk and what his genuine accomplishments. But look, the fact is that a company like Tesla and a lot of his ventures live on government contracts. These are not, you know, the free market heroes that they're made out to be in a lot of ways.
Right. You hear sometimes people in the Valley say they are libertarian, but they're not even really libertarian, are they?
I don't think so. I mean, they're libertarian in the sense that they, you know, they're very skeptical of any kind of drug laws, regulation, and any kind of, you know, basically any kind of, you know, behaviors of moral restraint that. But they're hypocrites about that. They're right. Exactly the reverse hypocrites that Charles Murray describes in Coming Apart, which is they advocate for a sort of libertinism in public policy, and then they don't practice it for the most part. You know, maybe they smoke dope in college or something, but most of them get over it, right? Because you can't live these productive lives that they do live. And these are this is essentially productive upper class. We're not talking about a class of entirely, you know, layabouts like the French aristocrats in the 1780s. These people produce, and they live, you know, aside from the fabulous wealth, they live more or less bourgeois lives with bourgeois habits. But they not only do they not, you know, preach what they practice, as Murray says, I think they actually spend a lot of their rhetorical ammunition and even their money preaching for destructive things like pot legalization and stuff that's just going to be devastating for the lower class, and it isn't really going to touch them.
Right. Now, I want to go back to something you said a minute ago, which is that redistribution is sort of passé as the old left. That seems does not seem to fit with either Occupy Wall Street or the Bernie Sanders campaign. Is there a split on the left that the old left doesn't really perceive?
Well, that's a good point. So touche. I mean, but look, Occupy Wall Street really didn't go anywhere. It fizzled, right? I mean, it doesn't seem to have energized the passions the way like Black Lives Matter has. And in fact, I read something recently that somebody made a persuasive case that BLM is just, it's the same left-wing coalition looking for an issue that it tried to find with the wars, right? So the left came together and they turned out 500,000 people against the Iraq war and certain things in the mid-2000s. I look at it this way. In living memory, not maybe shorter than that. But what are the big protest movements of the recent couple decades? Well, you had all the WTO anti-globalization stuff that turned people out. Starting in Seattle, they broke all the glass. And then it was the wars, right? Then it was Occupy Wall Street. You also had briefly the massive turnouts of the May Day parades over illegal immigration in LA and elsewhere. In the 2000s, BLM, right? BLM seems to be the first one where the left sort of starting to feel like it could be the 60s again, where this is going to have some staying power. All the rest of them just kind of fizzled and people didn't really care. Right. And I do think also the Bernie Sanders phenomena, I mean, Bernie himself is about wealth redistribution in a way, but you know, how much of that's really motivating his coalition? There were just a lot of college kids who wanted their student loans forgiven. I understand that. But it didn't seem like there was any great coherence behind it, whereas – you know, the people who really run the left today, you know, the big time Democratic donors, the Silicon Valley entrepreneurs, the media moguls and all of that, they have no interest whatsoever in wealth redistribution for obvious reasons. And for them, being on the left is a status marker. And it's a way of, I called it money laundering in my essay. It's a way of garnering legitimacy to themselves. They know they have all this concentrated privilege. And the way that they – as the same time that they're constantly denouncing white privilege in others, the way they legitimize it for themselves is they say, well, look, I have all the right opinions about all the things that are important, like fair trade coffee and Darfur and stuff like that. And so that makes me a good person, and it means that I deserve what I have.
Yeah, the phrase that's come to be used, I think now overused, is virtue signaling, right? Yeah.
Yeah, somebody – some British – I looked this up recently, and I don't remember his name. Some British journalist coined that apparently fairly recently, like in the Telegraph or something like that. And he was proud of himself for having that circle the globe and be used everywhere.
Right. It's been caught on like wildfire.
It may be over – it's one of these things, though, that you can't help but use it because it's so – its explanatory power is so great.
Right.
So I don't really begrudge him that, or I don't begrudge the its overuse, because in my view, whatever we lose by hearing the phrase over and over again and get tired of it, we need to be aware of it. We need to keep talking about it, because it's one of the defining moral. My attempt at coining the phrase was, I called it opinion morality. I meant exactly the same thing. Mine didn't catch on. His did.
Right.
But it's exactly the same thing. So morality is not defined, you know, the old Aristotelian ethics. This is what you need to do to be virtuous, right? That has almost no salience anymore. This is what you – it's not even what you need to think. But this is what you need to profess in order to be held virtuous. It's like Prince 15 from Machiavelli, you know, who makes a profession of good. You have to make a profession of good. You have to say, I believe this, you know, this is true about transgender bathrooms. The following is true about gay marriage. The following is true about this, this, and this. If you have that right set of opinions, you're a moral person in 2016, and you're entitled to you know, whatever sort of vast wealth and however you want to use or misuse it.
Yeah, it's a secular version of a church confessional.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Nicene Creed, something like that.
Right. Let's say a couple more things about California before moving on. You know, we conservatives in particular used to like to say California is a trendsetter for the nation. I mean, we brought the Sun Belt politics, Richard Nixon, Ronald Reagan, the tax revolt starting with Prop 13, term limits passed first here in California. And now the question is, is California still the future of the nation in any particular ways, and is now that a horrible prospect?
Yeah, and yes and yes. I mean, the nation will be – it becomes more like California every day, month, year. It becomes more divided. It becomes more ethnically diverse with whites and Asians and you know, Asians defined more broadly as East Asians, but also – you know, very talented people from the Indian subcontinent concentrating in high-income, high-paying sectors and with high educations at the top of society and with a much sort of blacker, browner, lower class and not much of a middle. So you have vast income inequality, you have vast educational inequality, incredibly stark differences in housing prices and the quality of local government and the quality of local schools and, you know, wealth inequality. I said that, but it's not just the people, but it's also the towns. You need I was just in Palo Alto last Wednesday visiting a friend of mine who was on the faculty of a local college. And the reason he can afford to live there is because he bought his place in 1981 and he could not afford to buy his own garage today at the price he paid for the whole house in 1981. And I said to him as we were driving to a restaurant, I said, I'm in the capital of the American oligarchy here. I mean, forget Washington. Washington just runs the government. Palo Alto really is kind of, in a way, it's the center of the universe now because tech has replaced, it's more powerful than, it's richer than Wall Street, more powerful and influential than Wall Street and Hollywood, and it's more glamorous than Hollywood.
Right.
It sort of is. For right now in the world and in America, you know, Palo Alto's king, and you know, places like inland towns, Lodi, Modesto, once sort of thriving agricultural communities. There's still a lot of thriving agriculture going on. The Central Valley still produces more food than anywhere in the world. But boy, the quality of public services, the quality of the housing stock, the crime rates, everything in these towns is just abysmal. It's really fundamentally two states, and it has been for a long time, and it's only getting more that way. And America is only getting more that way.
Yeah, no, I know you're a great fan, as am I, of that famous essay by James Q. Wilson from 1967 about California. And I think one of his summary phrases was, I think he called California Iowa by the sea. I mean, I grew up in Southern California of those days, and it was a state that made automobiles, it made airplanes, it made rockets. It was dominated by the engineers with the pocket protectors, right? And nowadays what you see is I mean, the thing I see most often in coastal California is somebody roll up in a fancy Mercedes or BMW and out steps some hipster with a ponytail.
Right.
Who's my age, you know, 50s, right? And I sort of – much to guess about what their ethos is like.
Well, part of the story too is remember that Wilson's main point, he was from Long Beach.
Long Beach.
And this was the 66 I know, I guess it was 67 because the Reagan election had just happened as governor.
Right.
And he said he had been asked by colleagues to explain, how could this happen? These Harvard colleagues who found it mystifying. This is, well, you're sort of an alien. You're from there. Tell us how sensible people could possibly have elected this guy who, you know, was in a movie with a chimp and who has these retrograde political views. And his basic point as he starts the essay is to compare the standard of living from somebody living in, say, Yorkville in Manhattan or, you know, one of the inner suburbs of Boston or the west side of Chicago to somebody in where he grew up in Southern California. Same basic job, same socioeconomic profile, same income. How do they live differently? And the difference was pretty vast, right? And this was not you know, people with beach houses in California. This was with an ordinary house in the central LA plain, you know, south of downtown LA on the way down to the harbor where the Beach Boys grew up. And small house, but it's a house, right? It's a real detached house. It has a front and a backyard. They probably have at least one car, and they might have two cars. And the kids have cars and all of this. And he says, I mean, there's just this massive middle class there that can live better on this. And they're probably getting paid a little bit more in California, which was still growing and filling up. And so had to attract workers with slightly higher wages than you could get elsewhere. So not only are you getting paid, I'm making this up, but, you know, marginally 10 to 20% more than you might make in another place. That same money also buys you vastly more. So it feels like your income is twice what it would be in terms of your standard of living in some big East Coast city. This explains these people's political outlook. So that California is completely gone. The California of the Brady Bunch, you know, of the right. famous series of the early 70s that grew up in the southern San Fernando Valley, ordinary family with a lot of kids, one income, in a ranch house that can perfectly well use the safe and effective public schools, right? Totally gone, right? Just to have that kind of lifestyle in LA or really anywhere in coastal California now requires, in real adjusted terms, multiples of the income that Mike Brady had, and the house would cost vastly more. And plus, you have to get out of the LAUSD, the LA Unified right. School District, and buy into some one of the, you know, the little pockets, like a Palo Alto, or in the Southern California equivalent would be a San Marino, or, you know, right. a Claremont or something, where the housing prices are yet higher still because there's a premium to get into that school district.
Right.
Or you pay in to get into a private school, which is, you know, $20,000-$30,000 in a big city like that.
Looking back, are there any identifiable turning points? I mean, you know, the aerospace industry disappeared at the end of the Cold War, or was it, you know, people like to beat up on Pete Wilson
yeah.
for the Prop 187?
That's total
immigration.
Nonsense. Beating up on Pete Wilson is nonsense. I mean, yes and no. There are things that accelerated it, and there are things that made it evident, but it was happening all along. And one of the things, an underappreciated fact, is just that, look, it's a great place to live, and the weather's nice, and there was all this industry, and it wasn't really that full, right? So if you're from Iowa or St. Paul, Minnesota, you know, like Charlie Schultz, Schultz, who moved to Santa Rosa, or it's one of these very dismally cold places with maybe not a lot of jobs or boring jobs, and you come through California on your way in or out of the Pacific in World War II, and you see it and you think, okay, so you're telling me I'm going to make more money than I would at home. It's never going to rain or snow. I can buy my own house for $10,000 and I can have two cars and, you know, I can have a bunch of kids and they'll all go to the local public school, which is fine. Okay, why am I going back there again, right? So people started to stay for obvious reasons and they flooded in. Now, right. a deal like that, you know, I mean, it's a very simple sort of supply and demand. When you have this underpriced asset, it's going to sell and the price is going right. to rise. So California was not going to be a cheap bargain for the entire world for 150 years. That was going to last 20 or 30 years tops. It had to end, and it ended, right? I don't think it had to end as fast as it ended because of a lot of reasons. Dumb policies is one of them. Above all, dumb immigration policy at the federal level, which vastly increased the population of the state to a point where its infrastructure really can't support them anymore. So California, 20 million people. The way I've always put it was, you know, California at 10 million people is paradise. At 20 million people, it's really great. 30 million, it's bearable.
Yeah.
But it's starting to get pretty bad. 40 million, it's borderline dystopia unless you make a fortune and can buy your way out of the troubles. And it's at like 39 now.
Yeah.
And it's right. too big for the amount of public infrastructure that it has in terms of the water system, traffic, public transportation, and all of that. There's just too many people wherever they came from. And when you have the, you know, the immigration issues and the language problems that weigh down a lot of public schools, it just makes everything more complicated.
Right. But, of course, it flipped politically. I mean, it voted for Republicans through, with a few exceptions, through 1988, and then it flipped under Clinton, and now
yes.
it looks like there's no
right.
way it's ever going back.
The 92 election was the ratification of something that had always been evident. It was happening, an underlying trend that people weren't paying a whole lot of attention to. And it went pretty big, and we missed the significance of it because 94 was, you know, a national earthquake election when the Republicans retook Congress.
Right.
Pete Wilson should have, by all accounts, lost his reelection bid as governor and because the state went through whatever the 90s recession was nationally that cost George H.W. Bush his job. It was much worse in California,
right.
especially in Southern California. Wilson began 1994 and, you know, dramatic budget cutting and cuts to public services, and his first two budgets were just disasters that made, and he had to raise taxes, which ticked off his own base. And he began 1994 with like a 20-point deficit to Kathleen Brown, who was the daughter of a former governor and the brother of a former and the current governor. But back then, right. He was only a former governor. And it was he was a surefire loss. And he came back. Not only did he come back to win, but the Republicans, the state assembly in California is unfortunately, it's an even number.
Right.
So, but they came back to 40-40. First time they had nominally controlled or even challenged control of it since Reagan had been governor. So that was kind of a false dawn. Oh, well, maybe not all is not lost.
Right.
And fooled a lot of people into thinking that the Republican future was still viable in the state. Clinton, of course, carried the state easily in 96. And then Dan Lundgren, you know, a guy who'd been elected to statewide office twice, right, and was popular and competent, and all, was crushed by the absolutely aptly named Gray Davis.
Yeah. I mean,
the least charismatic, right, man in history, beat him by 20 points.
I remember talking to Governor Wilson shortly after that election, and he was scratching his head saying, how do you lose by 20 points?
Yeah.
So, yeah. Yeah, that was surprising because Lundgren looked pretty good on the surface.
Well, I remember being at a small anecdote in 1998, but before the election. So I was working for Wilson, and I went to lunch in Sacramento, in downtown Sacramento, with an old friend of mine who, you know, was working in Sacramento at the time, and a political consultant who he knew that I didn't know. And as we talked about the upcoming election, all I was thinking as a young guy working for the governor who's termed out is, how do I get on with the new guy? Because I'm going to need a job in January. Not thinking, you know, taking for granted that he either would win or could win. And the guy said to me, you got to find something else to do, kid. The Republicans are not going to hold the governor's office this year. And I, you know, gave him my best reasons why. And he just sort of said, you're crazy. But the words that stuck with me was, you don't get it. California is a Democratic state. It's already happened. And I've poo-pooed that and sort of waved it off at the time. I realize now, of course, he was absolutely right. And it should have been obvious to everybody by, you know, June or July 1998, whenever that lunch was, that California was a Democratic state.
Yeah, and that's almost 20 years ago now. Let's switch to a happier subject. The Beach Boys.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was a great essay you wrote a couple of years ago now in the Claremont Review about what the long-delayed album of theirs.
Yes.
That
has become a kind of cultural touchstone. And since I wrote about it, I'm not saying that it was my essay. It had to have been in, right, development for years. But that album, first of all,
I forgot the name.
Remind Smile.
Me. Smile, that's right. The Smile Sessions.
Smile.
Right.
So it was, first of all, that essay that I wrote began with a reference to the James Q. Wilson article, because I don't remember Wilson pointing out specifically the Beach Boys, but the exact environment that he talks about, the two-bedroom house and the car and the flats below, south of downtown LA, is exactly the way the Wilsons grew up, right, in Hawthorne. The house has subsequently been torn down to build the 110 freeway. It's no longer there.
Right.
But, you know, it was a very small little place, but it was its own detached house, mm-hmm, with a front yard, a backyard. I'm pretty sure their father was from Iowa. There was just a massive influx from the Midwest into LA of a lot of Iowans and other Midwesterners. You know, they grew up that life with a father who was a machinist who kind of wanted to be a musician, and a mother who didn't work. And, you know, they could raise a fairly big family on one income, and everybody had enough.
Huh.
And, right, and those were the days in a lot of ways. And the you know, what are the early Beach Boys lyrics before Brian Wilson got ambitious? They're very lighthearted and fun, and they're just sort of, I was going to say they're materialistic. That's unfair, but they're about driving cars and surfing and playing around and having a good time in a sort of land of material plenty where you don't have to worry about anything.
Right, right. Well, one of the things that I never knew their story very closely, but I didn't realize how consciously they saw themselves in rivalry with the Beatles.
Well, when you say they, it was really Brian.
Right.
Right. It wasn't them. And
right,
this was a point of contention where, unlike the Beatles, you know, you have, you know, the least talented Beatle, I mean, I think everybody would agree, is Ringo Starr, right? A great drummer, but he only wrote a few songs. And George Harrison is sort of given short shrift because he didn't contribute as many of the songs. But a lot of that was like the political rivalry within the Beatles, where Paul and John just wouldn't – they'll give him one track, an album, and all of that. Some of it was George always consisted on playing the sitar, which,
right,
nobody, including me, even really liked. And I love the Beatles. The Beach Boys, on the other hand, really only had one musical genius, and that was Wilson. So it was kind of three against one in that sense. But Brian wanted to catch up with them. He wanted to do something that brought them to their level. And the first, you know, so he apparently, you know, he hears Rubber Soul blow him away, and he writes this album called Pet Sounds. and which they produced and they sang. And most of the other Beach Boys are kind of indifferent to it. And Mike Love, who was the front man, the singer, and the big star, opposed it but went along with it. And it was a huge critical success, now considered one of the greatest albums of all time. But it didn't make that much money compared to their earlier stuff. So Love said, we're not doing that again. We're going back to the formula. And Wilson didn't want to. And then the Beach Boys released Sgt. Pepper. And Paul McCartney explicitly said, this was our end. We thought that they had one-upped us with Pet Sounds, so we had to get them back with Sgt. Pepper. You know, now that's like the most iconic rock album probably of all time. Certainly one of the handful. And so Brian says, well, I'm going to beat them with this thing called Smile. And Smile was just all him. Very experimental, weird lyrics, strange music. Almost none of the old formulas were there. And the rest of the band really wasn't into it. And Mike Love especially hated it. And they gave Brian a lot of a very hard time over it. And he more or less, and he was doing drugs, so a lot of this he brought on himself. But Brian went crazy in the writing and the attempt to make that album and just quit. And they never finished it. And it became something that obsessed him for the rest of his life. And he eventually finished writing it like in 2004 or 5 or something, and took, two of the Beach Boys were already dead at that point, and took his own touring band to play it. And then eventually allowed the release of the original recording tapes and tried to put it in as close to a position as it would have been had there been a finished album. And, subsequently, I started by saying, you know, this has become a kind of a cultural touchstone. So not long ago, there was a movie, which I recommend, I enjoyed it, called Love and Mercy. And John Cusack plays Brian Wilson kind of in the current, in the modern age, you know, long after he was gone nuts. And Paul Dano plays him in the mid-60s trying to do Smile when he has the breakdown. The movie is really sort of a biopic about a woman, Melinda, who Brian Wilson meets in his 50s. And so she sort of breaks him free of this sort of abusive psychiatrist that he's seeing and ends up marrying him and saves him. And so it's all about how she's a hero who saves him. But it was a good movie that, you know, it goes into this, how that album kind of made him crazy and, you know, robbed him of a few decades of his life.
Yeah. Yeah. That's too often that seems to happen with genius, right?
Yeah. Well, I mean, to me, Smile is just as wonderful as pop music. The lyrics are stupid, but they're sort of silly in a fun way. And It's a patriotic album, which I don't think people really realize. There's all kinds of weird. He says it's about it's American history in an album. So there's references to the Pilgrims and Plymouth Rock and the railroads and all of this. But it's old school American history. It's not what you'd get in colleges today, where it's all oppression and slavery and the sins of the past. It's, you know, it's a sort of a heroic account of American history with these sort of bizarre childish lyrics and very inventive music.
Right. Let's move on to a similar example of a new school technique of old school ways of thinking about the world. And that's Tom Wolfe. It's one of your heroes. I think that's right. One of the formative influences on your own thought and style,
for
right?
Sure.
How'd you first get interested in Wolfe? And I'm not quite sure what the right question is to open this up, but why is he so? Well, there's nobody else like him, right? How did he come to be the way he is, do you think?
Well, I first got interested in him when I was an undergraduate at Berkeley. This is a weird piece of happenstance, but my roommate was still best friend, was a Korean kid from Glendale. And somehow he managed to meet this older Korean woman in Berkeley who took her under his wing. They weren't dating. She just liked him, and he would hang out with this woman named Melanie. And Melanie had this boyfriend who had claimed to have been a Black Panther in the 60s. And Berkeley is filled with all these new left and hippie cast-offs that just never leave, right, and try to relive the glory days. And one day, you know, you and I were talking about this the other day, the old famous old Cafe Med on Telegraph Avenue, which is actually – there's a scene in The Graduate shot there, or Through the Window.
Right.
We're there at Cafe Med, and the four of us – somehow I was there, and I listened to this guy just spew all this anti-American, anti-white bile. I thought – and I was 18. I never heard any of this. It's despite, you know, growing up a lot of my youth in Santa Cruz, which is another left-wing town. And I'm like, who the heck are these people? And I got – whatever, I looked it up, and I come across Radical Chic, which is something about the Black Panthers. Well, I'll read this. Maybe this will explain it. So this is a Tom Wolfe book.
All right.
A famous book, maybe the thing that more than anything made him a superstar. Well, Electric Kool-Aid Acid Test, too. But, you know, it's a book, but it's a – It's either a very short book or a very long magazine article, because it really describes one event, which is a party that Leonard Bernstein hosted for the Black Panthers in January of 1970 to raise money for them during a season of which Wolf called radical chic, when all of the high society in New York were giving parties for this or that new left violent agitator group. You know, there was a Puerto Rican one, there was a Mexican group, there were several of them, and you know, Chicago 7 had a party to raise money. So Wolf, he didn't actually even get invited. He was at the offices of Harper's Magazine, and he saw an invitation on David Halberstam's desk, not even to him, to David Halberstam, called the RSVP number, just boldly called the RSVP number and said, "I'm Tom Wolf from New York Magazine, and I'm going to come." And they went, "Sure." So he says, I wasn't false pretenses. I told them who I was and who I was with, and they seemed to want attention and welcome the press. And he went. And sat there and didn't talk. Basically, I don't know that he talked to anybody, because it doesn't have the usual interview stuff in it. But I asked him this once, how did you get all this detail? He was bursting with quotes.
Right.
So much quotes that, you know, he had been accused of sneaking in a tape recorder. Well, it turns out, Wolf being Wolf, he took the trouble to go to secretarial school and learn shorthand.
Wow.
So that he could take down as much conversational detail as possible. And he just sat there with one of those notepads with the rings at the top.
Yeah.
He just flipped it back and, you know, however many hours, and took down as much. And he writes a piece that was blisteringly hilarious. And it blew me away when I read it. I thought, I can remember having seen – this would have been 1989. I can remember having seen The Bonfire of the Vanities, which came out in 1987, on my mother's bedside table. So she must have bought it and either read it or tried to read it. I had no idea what it was about, even though it was the biggest book in the world at the time. No, this doesn't happen with a novel anymore, right? I mean, when was the last time a novel, all of America was talking about a novel? Maybe some Jonathan Franzen book like The Corrections or something from 2004, maybe.
Maybe, yeah.
But nothing like what Bonfire Vanities was in 87, which still didn't crack my skull until I read Radical Chic. And then I said, I have to read everything by this man. And I did read everything by this man. And one of the things that I found particularly what was compelling to me personally was that he wrote a lot about California.
Oh.
In fact, I later wrote a piece for City Journal called Tom Wolf's California that just goes into this, because I don't think anybody had ever covered it from that specific point of view. Especially in the 60s, Wolf was traveling out here a lot and doing a lot of his reporting in New York publications on what's going on in California in the 60s that nobody else was covering. And so when you go back and read his back catalog, you know, all the collections of essays, plus a book like The Electric Kool-Aid Acid Test, which is about Ken Kesey, the Merry Pranksters, and the first hippies, all of which is almost all the action takes place in California. And you realize there's a massive amount of California material here. And so I'm reading about stuff that's like right in my own backyard. I'm reading about things happening in Berkeley and Oakland, and, you know, scenes in Santa Cruz and right. Electric Kool-Aid Acid Test and stuff. That gave it an immediacy. And there was really nothing that he ever wrote that I didn't find completely enjoyable from beginning to end, didn't want it to end, and couldn't wait to read it again.
Right. All right, last subject for today. We could go on all day about this, but our listeners won't go forever. So rock and roll music, California culture, Tom Wolfe, but also Machiavelli. I mean, you're giving another paper on Machiavelli at the American Political Science Association. So.
Yes.
How do you explain your interest in Machiavelli and why he's more interesting to you than just about everybody else?
There's probably a million ways to answer that. Some of it, though, is the kind of lowbrow, in the sense that, you know, Leo Strauss makes the point that Machiavelli, there's a lot of puzzles in Machiavelli. You have to make lists, you have to count, you have to look for patterns, you got to put all these kinds of things together if you're really going to get what he's trying to say. And that one of the ways that he tries to hook readers is by with these riddles. You know, he fascinates the reader with riddles until a point where you become obsessed, where you just have to, it's like finishing a crossword. You just won't give up until you find the last clue and you fill it in. I'll never find the last clue in Machiavelli, because everywhere, every rock you turn over, there's this great menagerie of insects under it. You can't catch them all. And then as soon as you figure this one out, you look at some new angle and you realize that there's about 5,000 different ways, you know, new tunnels off the rabbit warren that you can go down. So I think if the smartest reader in the world did nothing but write a commentary his whole life on Machiavelli's book saying, I'm going to explain every puzzle, I don't think that could be done. Right. maybe you've got an army of people doing it. So I keep looking, I keep finding new things, and then, you know, it's a kind of like, it's kind of like being addicted to a video game. You're just like, I gotta keep playing. I gotta get to the next level or whatever. I gotta get to the next. No, I have to save the princess. Whatever. Every time I find something, I find some new thing, and I gotta solve that one. And then in the course of solving that one, you find some new thing, and then I gotta solve that one. It just sort of never ends.
Well, now everybody reads The Prince or knows The Prince at least, but there's so much more to Machiavelli. What are some of his other works that you think are?
Well, there's sort of the big two and the big four, and the big two are The Prince and The Discourses. And the reason why those are the big two is because in the dedication to each one, he says, "This volume contains everything I know." He uses different words in each one, but he basically indicates them that these are his chief works. And then in the body of those works, he refers to the others. So in The Prince, he refers, does not by name, but he says, I'm not going to talk about Republics because I've talked about them at length somewhere else. He means The Discourses.
Right.
In The Discourses, he actually does say, you know, I've spoken about this in my treatise on Principalities. He doesn't do that in any of his other works. So those two sort of stand alone. And the other two major works are the Florentine histories, often mistranslated as the history of Florence, but in the Italian it's plural, and The Art of War. And The Art of War is the Florentine history is what it sounds. It's a history of Florence from the founding of the city up until the death of Lorenzo de' Medici in 1492. And book one is – I highly recommend it. It's just because it's sort of Machiavelli's account of everything that happened in Italy from the fall of Rome right up until his time. So it's a little mini history of the Middle Ages. And then there's seven more books that basically just talk about Florence.
Right.
And then The Art of War is a dialogue – structured like a Platonic dialogue, a bunch of aristocratic people sitting around in a garden in Florence, at which Machiavelli himself claims to have been present but does not speak. And they talk about – basically the dialogue is, why are Italian military arms in their time, meaning the early 16th century, so pathetic? It's just so bad. And they ask one of the leading generals or condottieri of the time is the main – interlocutor, a guy named Fabrizio Colonna, and the people questioning him, among the people questioning him, are Machiavelli had this little philosophic circle of followers that were his sort of buddies, and two of them he dedicated the discourses to, Cosimo Rucellai and Zanobi Buondelmonti, and they're both also in the dialogue as characters asking Fabrizio Colonna to justify himself and explain. So, and they're highly metaphoric works. I don't know that there's a lot of metaphor in the Florentine histories. There might be. I haven't found it, if there is. But there's a ton of metaphor in The Art of War. So on the one level, it's just literally about how do you form up a line? Which weapons do you use? Do you place the pikemen here and the musketeers here? Oh, there wasn't muskets, but I forgot the name of it. But they had some
right.
They had some form of early rifle, which Machiavelli doesn't even think very highly of because it's so inaccurate. You know, how do you arrange the army? But then on another level, there's this sort of major argument about, or metaphoric level about spiritual warfare and propaganda, that the Art of War is sort of existing at that level. So that's a puzzle that you have to figure out again. You don't know it's a metaphor until you know, he'll write – the way Machiavelli alerts you to the fact that he's doing funny things is he says really stupid things sometimes that you either have to conclude, as a lot of scholars do, that, well, he was just kind of sloppy. You know, what are you going to do? He wasn't a systematic thinker. He writes something. He doesn't think about it. He never comes back to it. He just leaves it there. Or you take the Straussian approach, which is assume it's intentional. Try to think of a reason for it before you dismiss it. So when he says something dumb, as he does fairly frequently, you know, like in the middle of the discourses, he tries to argue that artillery is useless. It just doesn't, you know, it hasn't changed. He wants to argue the superiority of the ancients over the moderns. But in order to do that, he has to completely deprecate modern artillery, meaning cannon fire and stuff, which is, as we know, pretty effective, right? And so a lot of the arguments he uses to justify these positions are just absurd. They're just dumb. They're nonsensical. They don't make any sense unless you think, okay, there's a reason behind the madness, and I have to figure out what it is.
Yeah. You know, you referenced Leo Strauss, who wrote a famous book about Machiavelli, and then Harvey Mansfield's written about Machiavelli. I have to confess I haven't read Harvey's books on Machiavelli. Are there notable differences between the two scholars on Machiavelli questions?
I have not found them. Mansfield is, of course, self-identifies as a Straussian, did not study with Strauss formally. We can thank California for that, as I understand it. Mansfield's first job, so, you know, he got his PhD, basically his whole undergraduate, and then his graduate education was at Harvard. And he got a job at Berkeley teaching in the early 60s for at least one, maybe two at most, academic terms before he was rehired by Harvard and went back. But that happened to be a time when Strauss was on leave from the University of Chicago and had some sabbatical year at I think it was called the Institute for Advanced Studies, but it was one of these things on the Stanford campus. So he wasn't teaching.
Right.
He was just doing research and writing, but he was physically in Palo Alto. And Jaffa – So Harvey Mansfield Sr. was also a political scientist who knew Harry Jaffa, a former Strauss student. Jaffa then got to know Mansfield Jr. and said, oh, if you're going to be in California and you're going to be in the Bay Area, Leo Strauss is in Palo Alto. You have to go see him. Basically, go see him as often as you can. And Mansfield told me once that he would drive to Palo Alto every weekend, basically every Saturday, and they would do two things. One, Strauss had a reading group of a bunch of students that he would read with, and Mansfield was part of that. And second, they would do one-on-ones, the way Jaffa used to do with Strauss in the late 40s, before Strauss went to Chicago. And I think it was just that one year where they were personally in close contact, Jaffa, because Mansfield had already finished his PhD, and so he was already a working academic, but that changed him completely. Yeah. And he went back to Harvard. So he has written – obviously, he's the greatest translator of Machiavelli. He translated The Prince, co-translated The Discourses, co-translated The Florentine Histories. One of his students named Chris Lynch translated The Art of War. Chris Lynch is going to be on my panel at the APSA next week. And Mansfield's written two big books, and he's working on a third. So the first one was many big books. I suppose you could sort of say Taming the Prince is a kind of part of the Machiavelli.
Yeah.
But it's more of a general political science that that uses Machiavelli's books that are explicitly about Machiavelli. The first one was one of the in my view the greatest unheralded book of political philosophy scholarship ever. Not the greatest, but the greatest unheralded. It's called Machiavelli's New Modes and Orders, and it is a commentary on the Discourses, which goes through the Discourses fully, every chapter. No other book has ever done that in any language, including in Italian, and tries to explain them. It's unheralded because it's really hard to read. Mansfield does not say, okay, I figured this out and now I'm going to explain it to you in clear terms. What he says is, okay, I figured this out and I'm going to explain it, but I'm going to explain it in such a way that you are going to have to do almost all of the actual math and the adding and the building to figure it out for yourself, because I'm going to leave this very obscure. And so many people have started that book and just said, I don't want to. In fact, I'll tell you a little funny story, since I know you might find this amusing. When Harry Jaffa ran the Salvatore Center, in the 70s at Claremont. Salvatore Center is a little center at Claremont McKenna College, funded by Henry Salvatore, who was an early, maybe the first financial backer of Ronald Reagan as a politician, and also gave the money ultimately to found the Claremont Institute. But he gave this money to run a center at the Claremont McKenna College to support Jaffa's teaching and support various scholarship. And one of the things Jaffa did with some of the Salvatore money is he apparently gave a grant to Harvey to support Harvey on a sabbatical where he finished writing Machiavelli's New Modes and Orders. And then he gratefully – in fact, he's thanked. If you notice at the beginning of the acknowledgments of Machiavelli's New Modes and Orders, he says, money being the sinews of war, which is a takeoff of one of Machiavelli's chapters of the Discourse. It says, money is not the sinew of war, as is the common opinion. So Mansfield says, money being the sinew of war, I want to thank the Salvatore Center for giving this grant. And he gave Henry Salvatore a copy, or Jaffa did, as a thank you. And years later, Larry Arn was working on a kind of a monograph about Salvatore's life, and he asked me to help him with it and do some research. And I had these boxes and boxes of papers. I was going through them, and I found a letter from Salvatore to Jaffa, and it was Salvatore saying, I wish I remembered it word for word, because it was hilarious. It was very tart. It said something like, you've sent me this book. I started reading it. He doesn't draw any conclusions. He restates a bunch of facts, summarizes a bunch of sentences that I could have read in the Discourses, doesn't interpret them, doesn't tell me how to conclude them. And beyond that, I fail to see how this has anything to do with the study of, whatever the specific – he uses the specific language of what the Salvatore Center was for, what it has to do with this. And so I'm returning the book. Keep it and try to make a better selection for what you support next time.
Oh, no.
Very tart. I told Mansfield about that many years later. He didn't have much of a response to it. So many people have had that reaction to the book, which is, okay, I'm reading it and I'm not getting anything out of it. My view of it is you can get something out of it, but you got to put in a lot more effort than the average book requires. And I think what offends people is it's one thing for a primary source to be that dense and difficult, But if it's a secondary source purporting to explain a primary source, it should be more accessible. And he just – it isn't. So the second one is – that was 1979. The second one is a book called Machiavelli's Virtue, which came out in either 95 or 96. I want to say 95, which is a collection of all of his previously published essays on Machiavelli, save one, the title chapter of Machiavelli's Virtue, which was new for that volume. And then in 2013, he wrote a long piece for the New Criteria. Criterion.
Right.
I can't remember the name of it, but it was a sort of an extended meditation on the phrase Verita Effectuel from Prince 15, the effectual truth, and Machiavelli and the creation of science, and modern science, and the creation. You know, Machiavelli is the first to make a distinction between two forms of truth, sort of the fact and the non-fact, right? So for Aristotle, for instance, if I think I'm getting this right, there's no fact-value distinction, right? A moral claim is just as true as gravity or a mathematical claim. They may be amenable to different forms of proof, right? But there's no metaphysical difference between the trueness of them, right? Machiavelli is the first to say, not really, right? Gravity or 2 + 2 = 4, those are facts. All these moral arguments over here are something else, right? And that begins according to Mansfield, that begins the intellectual divide between modern science and modern morality and metaphysics. So he wrote that article and he says he's working on a book that will build that out. And he may be done for all I know. I could be out any time.
Well, we've gone from San Francisco to the Beach Boys to Tom Wolfe and Machiavelli. That's a pretty wide range. Thanks, Mike. It's been great fun.
Thank you.
Powerline is a production of PowerlineBlog.com. John Hinderacher, Scott Johnson, Paul Mierendorf, Stephen Hayward, Joseph Malchow, and produced by Madison McQueen in association with Ricochet.com.
Ricochet. Join the conversation.